The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. This week, we've asked some of our favorite scientists, science writers, and bloggers to help you with your last-minute holiday shopping. They'll recommend their favorite science books, some from 2012 and some classics, to help fill out anyone's bookshelf. We'll start with writer Scott Hewler. Scott blogs at Plugged In on the Scientific American Blog Network, and he's the author of On the Grid, A Plot of Land, An Average Neighborhood, and The Systems That Make Our World Work. Thanks for listening.
My 8-year-old son has recently taken to Sherlock Holmes. He discovered him in a tiny collection at his school library. I love watching Louis wrestle with Sherlock's cogitation, but he's discovering, as many have before, that Holmes engages less in gaudy ratiocination than in extreme observation. Holmes isn't smarter than we are. He's more aware. He's paying better attention. That's an entire philosophy of life, and it makes you wonder why nobody has ever written a self-help book. What would Sherlock do, or some such? In Mastermind, How to Think Like Sherlock Holmes, Maria Konnikova wonderfully goes one better. She shows how Holmes would perceive, process, and marshal data, and turn that data into usable information. She uses stories of Holmes's actions to show us how to practice, if not equal, his superhuman mental dexterity. What Sherlock Holmes offers, Konnikova writes, isn't just a way of solving crime. It is an entire way of thinking, a mindset that can be applied to countless enterprises far removed from the foggy streets of the London underworld. Consider, for example, Holmes's famous instant identification of Watson's service in Afghanistan. Konnikova does more than merely quote as Holmes explains how he reached his conclusion. She then goes on to cite neurological research about attention. And so she does throughout. Different chapters in Mastermind consider things like imagination, deduction, and education, always combining Holmes and current scientific research, creating a narrative as engaging as a Holmes adventure. And yes, narrative. Konnikova sprinkles throughout her memories of listening to her father reading her the Holmes stories and other books. Thus, Konnikova shares readers' wonder at Holmes' balletic reasoning, discovering it with us rather than for us. We're into yet another cycle of Holmes' reimagination at the movies and on TV. For those who want to understand why he continues to amaze us, the engaging Mastermind is the perfect companion. And anybody could figure that out.
Hi, I'm Leslie Brunetta, co-author with Catherine L. Craig of Spider Silk, Evolution and 400 Million Years of Spinning, Waiting, Snagging, and Mating, from Yale University Press. I came upon The Whale by Philip Hoare by accident in an independent bookstore while traveling. It had a nice cover, so I picked it up. And he had me from the first sentence, with its tone of melancholy, undermined suspense. This beautiful book is part memoir, part literary criticism, part capsule biography of Herman Melville, part travel guide to the whaling centers of New Bedford, Nantucket, Mystic, Hull on the east coast of England, Provincetown, and finally the Azores, where Hoare enters the sea and swims with a young sperm whale. And it is a history of cetology, a science founded on commerce. I learned many things I didn't know. Why whales don't get the bends, that whales have 4 stomachs, and sea lice, that no one really knows how long whales live, but some whales alive today may have been calves when Melville went to sea. I also didn't know that the Dutch were already whaling in the Arctic when the Mayflower set sail, or that the hundreds of whales swimming in Cape Cod Bay tempted the pilgrims to settle in Provincetown, that Ray Bradbury wrote the script for the movie of Moby Dick, or that Britain didn't begin to ban whale products until 1973, around the time public sentiment shifted from seeing whales as dangerous, sometimes vindictive, swimming fuel tanks and plastic factories whose flesh and fluids could also be turned into lubricants used in spaceships, inks, detergents, vitamin A tonic, insulin, lipstick, and cow feed. Instead, thanks to researchers, nature filmmakers, and environmental activists, we began to recognize whales as vulnerable fellow mammals victimized by our heedless exploitation of them and the seas. And here, Hoare's melancholic immersion in his topic bears out. We all know whale populations are in trouble. We all know we are the cause, whether because our ancestors benefited from whale products, or because the fishing nets that feed us, or the plastic junk we throw away, or the toxins we dump into our waters end up binding or choking or poisoning whales. But the human part of the tragedy, the part you feel in your bones after reading Hoare's book, is that, for all our affection for them, if whales go, we won't fully know what we've lost. Whales live their entire lives in an environment figuratively unfathomable to us, and Hoare eases us into that unfathomableness as he leads us through his reading and along his travels and into the water. By knitting his own experiences in and under the water, together with the accounts of whalers and whale researchers, both of whom spend most of their working hours waiting for whales to breach the boundary between their element and ours, Hoare gives us not just an account of the known facts and an account of what we don't know yet but are learning, but also a deep sense of what we might know but never will.
My name is Brian Clegg. I'm a popular science author with books including In-Flight Science, How to Build a Time Machine, The Universe Inside You, and Gravity. I want to tell you about Caleb Scharf's Gravity's Engines. Black holes are the rock stars of cosmology. With the possible exception of the Big Bang, nothing gets better press. And there's been plenty written about the guts of black holes. But in Gravity's Engines, Caleb Scharf turns the picture on its head and explores the interaction of black holes with the environment around them. The result is stunning. I can't remember when I last read a popular science book where I learnt as much that I hadn't come across before. In particular, Scharf's descriptions of the supermassive black holes in the centres of galaxies and how they influence the formation and structure of those galaxies is truly fascinating. What's more, this is no workmanlike bit of dull scientist droning like some books by astronomers. Scharf can wax lyrical when taking us on a journey through space. I particularly love the cosmic zoom fairly early on in the book, where he follows X-ray photons from a distant galaxy 12 billion light-years away, very cleverly linking their flight to events on Earth that were happening at the same time. The book is not without problems, though. Often the description is great, but sometimes it tips over into the flowery. It's difficult not to lose interest a bit when Scharf goes into the details of his own work in a lengthy section. The attempt to show that black holes are somehow responsible for life on Earth stretches the credulity. And worst of all, Scharf never admits how much of what's in the book is speculative, stating almost all of it as if it were unquestioned fact. I don't think scientists, especially cosmologists, do themselves any favours when they pretend they deal in absolute facts. This doesn't distract, though, from the reality that this is the best cosmology book I've read all year, and a must for anyone with an interest in black holes.
This is Ethan Siegel, science and health editor at TrapIt and writer of the science blog Starts With a Bang. I wanted to share with everyone my reviews of a couple of books for the holidays. The first one is called Trinity, A Graphic History of the First Atomic Bomb by Jonathan Federvorm. I really haven't run across a book quite like this format before. I've read graphic novels, but I've never read a scientific history in graphic novel format. And this story, the story of the first atomic bomb, goes all the way back and talks about radioactivity and nuclear energy from when it was first discovered, and talks about its entire history, richly illustrated and painting a really vivid picture of all of the major physicists involved, both leading up to its discovery and throughout the development of the atomic bomb. This is really fabulous, and although I can't give it justice over the radio, it's the illustrations here that really steal the show. This was a fast read for me and incredibly engaging, and the science and history both lined up very well with what I had already known, which tells me that the author really did his homework when it came to this. And it was such an innovation to see something like this in a graphic novel format. It really appealed to me, and I highly recommend Trinity, A Graphic History of the First Atomic Bomb by Jonathan Federvorm, for anyone looking for a nice science holiday read. I also wanted to recommend a second book, Science Left Behind, by Alex Berezo and Hank Campbell.
One of the things that drive me nuts are unsubstantiated claims, or even worse, completely false claims that run counter to what the science actually tells you. You may be, like everyone, entitled to your opinion, but if your opinion runs counter to what scientific fact demonstrates, your opinion is wrong. It's very common in our society to say that the right wing is anti-science, and indeed, things like their views on climate science and possibly on economics really run counter to what the evidence tells you. However, the right wing is not the only place where you find these anti-science arguments, and the left wing is full of them. In their book, Science Left Behind, Barrizo and Campbell really focus on these left-wing narratives that are anti-science. I personally live in Portland, Oregon, a bastion of left-wing thought, and we are opposed to fluoridated drinking water in our city, regardless of what the science says about it. We've also having discussions about whether organic food is healthier than its non-organic counterparts, and it isn't, about whether GMOs are dangerous to our health, spoiler, they're not, and other such issues like this. Do vaccines cause autism? No, they're one of the greatest public health boons of the century. And so this book, Science Left Behind, takes a real in-depth look at many of these issues. And while I don't agree with everything said in this book, or with many of the policy prescriptions that they give, this is, as far as I know, the best and first book to tackle many of these anti-science claims. It's worth a read, certainly for anyone who's infuriated by claims that the Republican Party in the United States is the anti-science one. Yes, some Republicans are anti-science, and some mainstream Republican policy runs counter to science, but there are huge anti-science elements among the political left as well.
I'm Marie-Claire Shanahan, science education professor, and sometimes guest host of Skeptically Speaking. And the science classic on my holiday giving list is Robert Park's Voodoo Science. And it opens with a phone call. I called Joe Newman at his home in Loosedale, Mississippi. I was surprised when he answered the phone. I had tried several times before and always got a recorded message offering his book, The Energy Machine of Joseph W. Newman, for $74.95. I explained that I was writing a book about ideas that are not generally accepted by science, and it would not be complete without a full account of his energy machine. He seemed suspicious. "It's all in my book," he snapped. And from that opening, we're treated to physicist Robert L. Park's experiences combating misleading, mistaken, and sometimes truly outrageous scientific claims. Park is the former chair of the Department of Physics at the University of Maryland, who in 1983 was recruited to open the Washington office of the American Physical Society, an organization of American and international physicists dedicated to sharing and promoting physics research. Park's position in Washington saw him called to provide testimony and advice to the U.S. Senate and various committees on everything from perpetual motion machines and cold fusion to the International Space Station and manned spaceflight funding. Voodoo Science is an often funny and always intriguing account of these experiences. Each tale contributes to Park's efforts to understand and explain why unscientific science continues largely unabated, and to illustrate how just a bit of critical thinking could go a long way. In the end, the reader has had a chance to laugh, to be more than a little shocked at the absurd plans that have been taken seriously, and to learn important and memorable lessons in basic physics. Anyone on your list with an interest in the people and processes of science will have a great time with this one. I'll be giving it to my stepfather, and I expect that he'll love it. I hope he's actually not listening. Well, I think he'll like it so much that it won't even matter if I've ruined the surprise. So that's my recommendation. Voodoo Science by Robert L. Park, published in 2000 by Oxford University Press.
This is David Dobbs. I really enjoyed this year reading David Quammen's Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. It's about diseases that reside usually harmlessly in other animals, but can spill over with deadly effect to humans. HIV, SARS, bird flu, swine flu, Ebola. And they spill over because we humans increasingly disrupt the ecosystems in which these viruses and bacteria live. And when we do so, we often make ourselves attractive pathways for them. And the ecosystems that hold most of these bugs, these scary bugs, are the ones we're disrupting the most and will increasingly disrupt in the coming decades. Scary. What's scarier is, well, you know how people say viruses can't get too deadly or they'll kill all their hosts and die out? Well, Quammen has bad news for you, because while these viruses he's looking at have huge effects on humans, we are not what these bugs are about. We're just part of the complicated pathways that these viruses already live in, often have lived in for decades or centuries. And we make ourselves often just handy amplifier species in whom the virus can explode, bloom. Quammen tells this story just beautifully. He concentrates on people who were trying to figure out how these viruses work and follows them all over the world as they do this work. And he knows just how to treat this kind of material, when to zoom in, when to zoom out, when to explain, when to just let a story run. And he knows how to lay these big scientific stories down in layers so that you accumulate this knowledge slowly, and all along the way, you're being taken on one fascinating trip after another. But I think the thing I like most of all, given the problems that science writing is having lately, is that Quammen doesn't try, with every chapter and anecdote, to resolve a mystery. He's constantly shedding light, but the light usually reveals, along with something very interesting, more caves, more dark spaces to which we need to explore. And this is more true to the real state of progress, the growing island model, as some people call it, that the more we expand our knowledge, the bigger becomes the boundary between what we know and what we don't understand. Too many people writing about science ignore this. They write as if they or the people they write about have the answer. They don't. They never do. They never will. But science's beauty is not the answer. It's the hunt. You should hunt this book up.
David Dobbs blogs at Neuron Culture for Wired Science. He's the author of the book Reef Madness and the number one Kindle single bestseller, My Mother's Lover. We'll be back with more of our best science books of the year after this.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. To be a part of the discussion, call and record your question on our listener question line at Speak 73101. That's 773-257-3101. Long distance charges may apply. Sunday nights at 6 Mountain Time, join our Ustream chat room to listen and ask questions as we record interviews live. Just click the Listen Online button at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also email your questions and comments to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at Skeptical Radio. To find out where Skeptically Speaking airs near you, to listen to past episodes, or download the weekly podcast, check out our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, follow the links to connect with us on our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, or to subscribe to the show in iTunes. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm Desiree Schell, taking a step back and letting our guests share some of their favorite science books in order to help you take care of the science lovers on your gift list. Here's biological anthropologist, science blogger, and regular Skeptically Speaking guest, Greg Layden.
This year, we have an excellent crop of science books, and if I had to pick one, it would probably be George Church's Regenesis, because it is the only book in the futurism category that I've read that is worth reading. But instead, I want to reach back into the past and suggest a different book, Demonic Males by Richard Wrangham, from which I'll now read a brief passage. A new philosophy has emerged in the last decades, an evolutionary brand of feminism that sees the emergence of patriarchy as an intimate part of human biology. Evolutionary feminists, like Sarah Hurdy, agree with traditional feminists about the evils of patriarchy, but they do not disconnect humans from their biological past. The logic of evolutionary feminists appreciates the rich details of patriarchal history, but it simultaneously rejects the notion of plumbing the human condition through reading merely the last 6,000 years of history. Evolutionary feminists would insist that people can think about the evolutionary pressures that elicit rape or other forms of violence without necessitating any absurd pronouncement that because rape is natural, it is in any way forgivable. After all, no one considers the case of the black widow spider, who kills and eats her male counterpart after mating, to mean that murder and cannibalism are okay. Patriarchy is worldwide and history-wide. and its origins are detectable in the social lives of chimpanzees. It serves the reproductive purposes of the men who maintain the system. Patriarchy comes from biology in the sense that it emerges from men's temperaments, out of their evolutionarily derived efforts to control women, and at the same time have solidarity with fellow men in competition against outsiders. Demonic Males by Richard Wrangham. If you've not read it, you're doing it wrong.
Hi, this is Nicole Gallucci, a.k.a. The Noisy Astronomer, and I'd like to tell you about my favorite book of 2012, which is Nocturnal by Scott Sigler. This is a sci-fi, buddy cop, horror monster story set in modern-day San Francisco. And Scott Sigler uses science to explain his monsters. So if you're a nerd, if you're a biology nerd, science nerd of any kind, you will get your science fix as well as having the pants scared off of you. If you've read his original version of Nocturnal, you still want to check out this new version. It is super cool, packed with action, packed with fun, blood and guts. You may have nightmares, but it is totally worth it. Nocturnal, Scott Sigler. Check it out.
Hi, this is Ian Cromwell, author of The Crimeanist Manifesto at Freethought Blogs. Storytelling is one of the few human endeavors that crosses all cultural barriers. One of the reasons we so love Carl Sagan is because he told us stories that had all the qualities of a good science fiction novel, but were based on science fact. And they allowed us to look at the world around us with the same childlike wonder that was once reserved for the supernatural. It's this kind of wedding of the power of scientific truth with the magic of a good story that makes Bill Bryson's A Short History of Nearly Everything stand out in my mind as one of the great science books of our era. Bryson approaches our current scientific understanding of the world with a storyteller's voice. Not being a scientist himself, Bryson is nonetheless a passionate and engaged mind who's driven to explore the world of science with a question that's near and dear to the heart of skeptics and five-year-olds alike. How do you know that? How do we know how old the universe is? How do we know that matter is made of atoms or that life evolved? Many of us who have studied the sciences know the facts. Radioactive decay, the double slit experiment, natural selection. But how many of us know the stories that lie behind those facts? Bryson, in his own quest to learn things about the universe, takes us along with him on his journey through these stories. Through his eyes, we learn about what bird shit has to do with the Big Bang. We learn about the petty squabbles and territorial assholery that created the field of geology. We learn about how an attempt to explore the oceans resulted in a machine that makes breakfast cereal. Under Bryson's expert pen, science is transformed from pristine ivory tower Promethean offerings to the result of a struggle that is very, well, human. Science is, to Bryson, the story of people who, for the same reasons that drive us all, never stopped asking why. And A Short History of Nearly Everything is the perfect companion piece for those of us who never stop asking how. This book is a must-read for scientists and non-scientists alike, and should be on the bookshelves or e-readers of every teenager, every science teacher, every thinking person who has the means to read it. Our world is full of stories, and Bill Bryson's book tells us those stories with wit, empathy, and tireless wonder.
Hi, this is Michael Cruz from Bad Science Watch. A common theme in the world of alternative medicine is the offering of a cure for all disease, the antipode to the cause of all disease. When it comes to cancer, so-called miracle cures are offered up as a panacea, only to be abandoned later for the next big thing. Siddhartha Mukherjee, in his book The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, offers up a grim and fascinating look at the story of cancer from ancient to modern times. One that, in stark contrast to the oversimplification of snake oil salesmen, grows ever more complex the closer we look at it. Rather than a cold academic approach, Mukherjee tethers his book to the emotional mire of one doctor's attempt to come to terms with the seminal problem faced by his predecessors. How can we heal the patient of cancer without killing them first? The great and terrible competition in the early to mid-20th century between ever more radical surgery on the one hand and poisonous chemotherapy on the other gives way to the rise of the war on cancer, led by passionate but naive philanthropists and politicians. and the imperative to find the next valuable treatment before the last one stops working and the patient perishes. Mukherjee's prose are accessible and not bogged down by too much technical detail, but are replete with the frustration and imperative to succeed felt by the early cancer researchers. His own story serves to drive the narrative onwards, and he never lets us forget that though scientific curiosity brought scientists and physicians to the bench, they all had to look into the eyes of a suffering patient desperate to live, and they realized that this kind of research was the patient's only hope for remission. If you want to know the true face of cancer, the one that does not succumb to miracle cures and wishful thinking, but instead only bows to the lifelong work of compassionate and obsessed researchers and clinicians, then pick up The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, by Siddhartha Mukherjee.
I'm Brian Svitek, author of the books Written in Stone and My Beloved Brontosaurus. I write about paleontology for National Geographic's Phenomena blogs. The science book that really caught my imagination this year was All Yesterday's, Unique and Speculative Views of Dinosaurs and Other Prehistoric Animals by John Conway, C.M. Coastman, Darren Naish, and Scott Hartman. While All Yesterday's might look like a glossy, dinosaur-filled coffee table book, it's actually something much more. It's simultaneously a fantastic exploration of prehistoric possibilities, and also a stinging critique of how artists restore extinct animals. Conway and co-authors illustrate their argument in two parts. The first has fun with dinosaurs and other prehistoric creatures in speculative vignettes that are nonetheless based on observations of living creatures. Perhaps some plesiosaurs, like wobbegong sharks, had camouflage skin and little accessory fringes that allowed them to blend in with the bottom. And maybe the little dinosaur Laenosauria, which lived within the Cretaceous Antarctic Circle, would have been shielded from the cold by an insulating coat of downing fluff. And the authors provide some alternative takes on prehistoric behavior as well. Sexually frustrated stegosaurs might have tried to hump whatever unfortunate dinosaur crossed their path, a behavior sometimes seen among modern animals. And despite the fact that we're used to images of Tyrannosaurus rex terrorizing other dinosaurs, even the tyrant king would have to curl up and sleep sometimes. While the first portion uses anatomy and behavior of living animals to speculate about prehistoric life, the second half of the book uses common paleoart tropes to imagine how paleontologists of the future might restore familiar animals such as cats, cows, and elephants. If hypothetical future artists looked at a cat skeleton without any knowledge of the animal's fur or soft tissue anatomy, they might stretch muscle and skin to create a tight fit on the feline's frame, creating a devilish smooth skin monster. In fact, this is what many actual paleo artists have done with dinosaurs, what Conway calls shrink-wrapping the skeleton with little speculation about accessory structures and appendages. Simply draping skin on bone might be the conservative way to go, but as the authors show with their images of reptilian venomous baboons and vampire hummingbirds, estimates based on skeletons alone don't necessarily reflect an animal's true nature. Based upon all the ornaments, body coverings, and odd behaviors of modern animals, we have actually probably been underestimating how weird dinosaurs really were. We may never know the full extent of dinosaurian oddities, but All Yesterday's pushes paleontologists and artists to reach beyond the bounds of fossil bone and stretch speculations about what these animals were like in life. Our imaginations might be limited to the relatively few fossil bones we have to study, but biology has never been so constrained. All Yesterday's is a beautiful tribute to that fact.
Hi there, this is Rebecca Watson, founder of Skeptic.org and its various sister sites, and co-host of the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe podcast. As you may guess, I read a lot of nonfiction science writing, so it was difficult to pick just one book for this review. So I've decided to talk about the one bit of fiction I've read in the past, year, just to mix it up. This book only really qualifies as sci-fi on a bit of a technicality, but I am a rebel. Margaret Atwood's book, The Blind Assassin, is so hardcore, TSA agents recently took it out of my bag on my way into the airport, and they ran it through the X-ray again on its own just to make sure it wasn't a bomb. The book is actually a story within a story within a story. The overarching narrative is a first-person account of the life of Iris Chase, who's an old woman at the time of the story's telling. She recounts the years she spent growing up as the daughter of a once-successful button factory owner and the sister of Laura, a weird and unhappy girl whose suicide is recounted in the opening pages. Interspersed with that narrative is a second story, a novel apparently written by Laura but published by Iris following Laura's death. The novel concerns a romance between two unnamed lovers who meet secretly in quiet parks and seedy backrooms. During those meetings, the man entertains the woman by spinning a science fiction tale known as, yes, The Blind Assassin. So there you have it, a story within a story within a story, which somehow manages to be nowhere near as confusing as Inception. And because the third level narrative is science fiction, I believe this more than qualifies it for a review in this series. Plus, The Blind Assassin is pretty much perfect for anyone who loves Desiree Shell, which, if you're listening to this, you'd better. Not only are there science fiction elements, but the novel also works in strong social justice themes, workers' rights, violent activism, women's roles and the sacrifices they had to make in order to maintain their independence. Plus, it's Canadian. It's like Margaret Atwood sat down at her desk with a pen in one hand and a picture of Desiree in the other and got to work. So, The Blind Assassin, please read it because it's awesome.
Hi, this is Jim Kekelius. I'm a physics professor at the University of Minnesota and the author of The Physics of Superheroes and The Amazing Story of Quantum Mechanics. I would like to talk about one of the best science books that I read that came out in 2012, Maggie Kurth-Baker's Before the Lights Go Out, Conquering the Energy Crisis Before It Conquers Us. My own field in physics touches on issues of energy. I can tell you, as someone who does this for a living, that Maggie Kurth-Baker knows what she's talking about. We are in the midst of an ongoing energy crisis because we will not have enough energy for our growing needs in the next few decades. We rely on a system, a grid, that evolved over 100 years with no real forethought. And there's only so much natural gas, only so much petroleum, so much coal available in the world. We have to do something. Maggie clearly and cogently points out there's no easy answer. She explains all the different options, all the different things that people are trying, how at the end of the day, we're probably going to have to try all of them. She provides history of how we got to where we are, and she uses that as a guide to talk about the evolution of the grid and evolution of electric power. You will read this book, and I guarantee you, every time you flip on a light switch in a room, you'll think about the things that you read about in this book. If for no other reason than Maggie correctly points out that every time you flip on a light switch, your electric power plant has to work just a tiny bit harder in order to provide that energy. That all the electrical energy that we use is freshly squeezed. It's a fun page-turning read that will make you smarter and will give you important information for going forward on what we need to do individually and as a nation.
My name is Michael Payton. I am National Director of Center for Inquiry Canada. I've been involved as a researcher and a student of cognitive neuroscience for quite a few years now. I now spend my time educating and advocating on behalf of science and reason and the values of those disciplines. My first introduction to neuroscience was through an introductory book on psychology I had found at a high school library. It detailed the case of Phineas Gage, a railway worker who, through an unfortunate accident, had a tramping iron shot through the front left hemisphere of his skull. While Mr. Gage survived the accident and went on to become a minor celebrity due to the accident, people near to Mr. Gage found that his personality had changed quite drastically. There is something deeply fascinating about these cases which draw people to the interest and study of neuroscience. That is why I can think of no better person to introduce the topic to a lay audience than Dr. Ramachandran. Dr. Ramachandran focuses study on exactly these types of cases and offers the reader a glimpse into the implications they have for medicine, for art, for philosophy, for science, and even for readers who are less academically inclined. Dr. Ramachandran offers a needed challenge to our everyday understanding of ourselves. Dr. Ramachandran's studies are profoundly vivid and fascinating. They present explorations of rare neurological conditions that would be of interest to both experts and lay people alike. I now wonder how many young people, like myself, will be motivated towards the study of the brain after reading about, for instance, Capgras delusion. Capgras delusion is a rare syndrome where the patient is convinced that friends or close relatives have been kidnapped and replaced with imposters or spies that disguise themselves as their loved ones. In a rare and welcome move for a practicing researcher, Ramachandran also opens speculative conversations about the role of cognition and neuroscience in art and philosophy. Oftentimes, the popularizers of science have a delicate task, to report the findings in such a way as to be articulate, while still maintaining the excitement and drive which motivates researchers working in the field. This is a balance that Ramachandran achieves perfectly. I encourage everyone to read A Brief Tour of Human Consciousness. Center for Inquiry Canada is an educational charity devoted to promoting reason, science, and freedom of inquiry. You can find more about this organization and our work at cficanada.ca.
Hi, this is Cy Curious. I blog at Scientific American's The Cy Curious Brain and at Scientopia Blog's Neurotic Physiology. For this year's science book recommendation, I would like to recommend Angel Killer by Deborah Blum. I would say that I couldn't put it down, but it was an ebook, so really I couldn't click away. While it may not seem like a science book at first, in reality it is intensely scientific. It is a recounting of the story of Albert Fish, an unassuming-looking man who was, in reality, a horrible serial killer. But it's not just about the grisly tale of a serial killer brought to justice, it's also about the history of psychiatry and courtroom defense, which is something we struggle with even today. Who among the violent is truly insane? Are we capable of punishing them? Are we capable of treating them? And is there some way that we can do both? Angel Killer, it is fantastically well written. It is a wonderfully fast-paced read. I can't recommend it enough. So if you get a chance, please check out Angel Killer by Deborah Blum.
Am I my genes? In one sense, it is a ridiculous question. Of course not. We are not lumbering robots living only to fulfill the whims of our DNA. If anything has come out of the Human Genome Project, it is that genes are not even close to destiny. Human beings are complicated, and biology, like National Football League games, is hard to predict. And yet, in this eminently readable book, psychiatrist and director of the bioethics program at Columbia University, Robert Klitzman, brings back dispatches from people for whom genetic disease is more than an abstraction. He speaks with dozens of people at risk for or suffering from three diseases whose outcome is largely shaped by mutations in single genes: hereditary breast and ovarian cancer, Huntington's disease, and the enzymatic disorder alpha-1 antitrypsin deficiency. These are people for whom the question, "Am I my genes?" is not born of a failure to understand human variation or a penchant for hyperbole, but rather from the cold reality of their family's draw in what can feel like a cruel game of chance. To be a healthy young person and know with certainty that you will succumb to an inexorable neurological decline over a period of many years, a la Woody Guthrie, is utterly unfathomable to most of us. To be that same person and to have already endured physical and emotional abuse at the hands of a parent with the same disease is to have suffered a horror even more unimaginable. This is what it can mean to live in a family stricken by Huntington's disease. And yet, Klitzman's interviews reveal a range of responses to genetic disease. Yes, there is misery, there is guilt, there is regret and anger. There is also humor, stoicism, and most striking, resilience. This is perhaps the most profound lesson of Am I My Genes, and the one that should be most instructive to bioethicists, clinical geneticists, and anyone else who would presume to, quote-unquote, protect people from knowledge about their own biology. Information can be painful in the extreme. It can test our mettle in ways we cannot have conceived of. It can be a source of great uncertainty. But it can also help us to move forward and make choices about how we want to live. Am I My Genes is not, finally, a catalog of human frailty, but rather a testament to human strength and dignity.
That was Misha Angrist, assistant professor of the practice at the Duke University Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy. He's the author of Here is a Human Being, At the Dawn of Personal Genomics. And we'll be right back with more after these messages.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we're looking back at some of the most important science news of 2012. Writers Maren McKenna and David Dobbs, Boing Boing Science editor Maggie Kroth-Baker, and paleontology blogger Brian Sweetek join us to share the stories that made headlines and others that made an impact without receiving as much attention. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, on your local radio station, or online at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to the Skeptically Speaking 2012 Science Book Spectacular. I'm Desiree Schell, and if you're looking for books to satisfy the science lover this holiday season, we've got a few more recommendations for you. Here's David Weinberger. David is a senior researcher at Harvard Law's Berkman Center for the Internet and Society and co-director of the Harvard Library Innovation Lab at Harvard Law School. He's also the author of several books, including Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and The Smartest Person in the Room is the Room.
One of the best books that I read this year is actually one that I reread. It's Steve Johnson's The Ghost Map that came out in 2006. It tells the story of the discovery that cholera is caused by people sharing a dirty water source, one that contains human feces of people who've contracted cholera. This is a story that's been told many times, but Steve really brings something important to it. It's his first fully narrative book. I love Steve's essays. This is the first real story that he's told, and it's actually multiple stories woven into one. It certainly tells the sort of canonical story of the discovery of the cause of cholera outbreaks, the story of John Snow, who compiled a map of the deaths. This is the ghost map of the title. So he mapped where the bodies were, more or less, and realized that they centered on the Broad Street pump. But Steve's point is that this story is incomplete, that realization wouldn't have occurred without other people and other sorts of maps. Steve says that we also needed the map, so to speak, that Henry Whitehead had in his head. He was a local curate. He ministered to the victims in this area. He was very local, and he knew not simply the abstraction of where the corpses were, where people had died, which was crucial, but he also had intimate local knowledge about the particular families who were suffering. Likewise, Steve argues, we needed another sort of map, a map of the infrastructure, the sewer system of London. He tells, by the way, the story of the sewer system of London in a way that is quite fascinating. But we needed that type of map as well. We needed to see this from multiple points of view, and at their intersection, we're able to make the deduction that it was the pump that was the center of the outbreak. The book itself represents this, is an embodiment of this idea, because it itself is a book that weaves together these multiple points of view. And Steve is a very learned and cultured writer. He brings in ideas and influences from all over. It's a narrative that is surprising, not primarily because of twists in the plot. We know what the basic plot is. It's surprising because Steve keeps surprising us with new ideas, new insights, new ways of seeing things. I love the book. It's fascinating. And it makes very clear and vivid the point that we don't know through a single map, through pure deduction, through pure induction. We need a multiplicity of viewpoints, often represented by a multiplicity of people who are in connection with one another, whose knowledge is in connection with each other. And only out of that do we get knowledge and even science.
Hi, this is Dr. Pamela Gay from AstronomyCast. I have to admit, in the past year, I haven't had a chance to sit down and read a new science book cover to cover. Instead, in those moments between research, writing, and reading journals, I found myself generally reading fiction books. One of the most intriguing books I read this year is Paolo Bacigalupi's freshman novel, The Wind-Up Girl. Set in a dystopian future, where genetically engineered crops and animals have devastated the biodiversity of the world, Bacigalupi breathes life into a newly imagined nightmarish reality. Beyond putting all control of foodstuff into the hands of multinational megacorps that control the rationing of GM seeds, this novel adds in the horrors of a world with rising sea levels, a collapsed oil supply, and even genetically modified humans that are sterile and cast into slavery. With all the action set in Thailand, the wind-up girl is able to realistically consider a worst-case reality of how all these issues are faced in a developing nation where democracy has less bearing on reality than corruption and graft. For all its darkness, Bhagakalupi doesn't condemn his audience to a state of total hopelessness. Like all good dystopias, The Wind-Up Girl presents the reader with broken heroes who are fighting to liberate their people and perhaps even create a better future for themselves along the way. Throughout this otherwise dark novel are scattered moments of love, beauty, and dreams of freedom that make the darkness bearable. Winner of the Hugo Nebula and several other writing awards, The Wind-Up Girl is a must-read for the speculative fiction lover who is ready for an Earth-based, biology-focused, dystopian nightmare with a fragile inner lining of hope.
Hello, my name is Glendon Mello, and I am a science illustrator. I blog at glendonmello.blogspot.com, as well as on the Scientific American blog network. I co-blog at Symbiotic. It's a blog at the intersection of art and science. My pick for the end-of-the-year book gift list is ABC Dinosaurs, with illustrations by Scott Hartman. You can find his work online at skeletaldrawing.com. The book was put out by the American Museum of Natural History and published by Sterling Publishing. I'm a new dad, and my son's going to be 2 in a few weeks, and when I wanted to look for his first dinosaur book, it was important to me. It absolutely had to have feathered theropods. That's the feathered meat-eating dinosaurs throughout the book. I wanted it to be as up-to-date as possible so that as my son grows up, he's looking at the best possible dinosaurs he can look at. I saw the book on the shelf, actually in a toy store, and picked it up, and it was perfect. It's large, full-color illustrations with dinosaurs interacting with the letters of the alphabet that match the first letter of their name, just right for my toddler. It's also printed on cardboard stock, which is also great for a toddler. And as I was flipping through it, really happy to see all the feathered theropods and some unusual dinosaurs, some of the ones that I don't remember from when I was a child, some of the ones out of the bone beds in China, are featured heavily in the book. And I fell in love with the book, not even realizing that it was done by one of my favorite illustrators until I saw his name on the spine. That was it. I was sold. I highly recommend it. It's a fun book. My son uses it to practice the ABCs and make a lot of growling noises. And to me, that's a perfect reading experience right there.
I am Josh Witten. I am a writer and manager of the Finch and Pea online public house for science. I wanted to tell you about the book Rare Treasure, Mary Anning and Her Remarkable Discoveries, written and illustrated by Don Brown. This is a kid's book extolling the virtues of scientist and fossil discoverer Mary Anning, who was the first to discover an essentially intact fossil of an ichthyosaur. To me, the greatest virtue of this book was that when I was living in Cambridge, England with my family, we could go down to the Sedgwick Museum at the Department of Geology in the University of Cambridge, where they actually keep Mary Anning's ichthyosaur. So we could read the book, read about Mary Anning's life and discoveries, and then actually go down to the Sedgwick Museum at the Geology Department in the University of Cambridge and go and look at the ichthyosaur that she discovered. So what I think is really great about this book is something that could also be great about a lot of other books you can find in your bookstore or library, is that it's about a scientist, it's about a great female role model for my daughter, but it also has a personal, relevant connection to our lives. A central figure in the book, the fossil of the ichthyosaur, was something that I could go and actually show my daughter and bring what is in the book in the abstract into her real world and inspire her. And I think that's something that we can all go out and find for those people that we're trying to inspire with an interest in science in our lives.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Saunders, By day, I work in the IT industry, helping people build websites and create website solutions. And by night, occasionally, I work with Desiree on Skeptically Speaking. So the book I want to recommend is a really interesting book called Watching the English, The Hidden Rules of English Behavior by Kate Fox. Kate Fox is a social anthropologist, and she's actually English herself. So the way the book is presented is really interesting. She's basically going through and trying to sort of decode English behavior by being a participant observer, using a lot of the same techniques and tools that you would use as a cultural anthropologist going to investigate a hunter-gatherer culture or a foreign culture. And she's turning that cultural anthropologist eye and that social anthropologist eye into her own culture, which is really fascinating. And she discovers there's some really interesting things that don't quite make a lot of sense on the surface, or that sound really weird once you start to put them into words. And she goes through and she does a lot of tests herself. You know, she's basically creating a hypothesis. She goes out and tests the hypothesis herself and creates these sort of experiments that she can do, sometimes with unwitting participants, so that they're sort of somewhat blinded, I guess you could say. But the book is also really entertaining, just partly because of the subject matter, but also because of the way she has to go in and kind of look at her own culture using a sort of scientific and sometimes slightly foreign eye, but she can't always distance herself entirely from it. There's a really great section where she goes into trying to jump cues, and she gets really upset about it and kind of anxious, and it makes for a really excellent section of the book when she has to go and test some of her hypotheses with people and the way they react to cue jumping and how it's taboo in that society. And of course, the only way she can test this is by going to somewhere where there are cues and jumping the cues. And she has a lot of social anxiety about doing this, but she does make it happen. I definitely recommend this book for anybody who has ever said, anthropology, that's not a science. It's totally a science, even though you can't always get hard and exact facts. There is a methodology involved. And this book shows you as much about the methodology as it does about the topic of sort of Englishness itself.
Tom Levinson here. I'm a writer and documentary filmmaker who by day works as a professor of science writing at MIT. One of my favorite science books of the year is John Gertner's The Idea Factory. It's an account of the rise of AT&T's fabled Bell Labs, the lab's extraordinary accomplishments, and the story of its still shocking decline into near complete irrelevance. Purely as history, Gertner does a marvelous job of reminding us just what an extraordinary institution AT&T, Ma Bell, the phone company, really was back in the early years of the 20th century. The network it built across the United States, the phone system, was the most complicated machine ever conceived to that time. And to keep that machine running and to improve on it, AT&T built its unique laboratory. As Gertner makes clear, much of what the lab did was development, innovation, steadily improving on the established technology of that vast phone system. But the real break with the usual habits of industrial research, this new institution, this Bell Labs, poured a ton of money into pure research. The lab even had its own math department. Gertner chronicles the results. Inventions, most famously the transistor, that, you know, is the foundation of basically everything electronic in our lives these days. And ideas, like information theory, which was invented by Claude Shannon, who is probably one of the least well-known great minds of the 20th century. And that piece of work informs everything from the movement of electronic information really anywhere, but, you know, in the phone in your pocket, in the way we analyze genomes, you know, that's where Claude Shannon lives on. And, you know, it's in these parts of the book that Gertner really shines. His accounts of the very complicated science behind these ideas and discoveries is not just clear, it's really fascinating. But that said, Gertner is actually writing an institutional history here. He dives into both the personalities and the organizational decisions that made it possible for the men of Bell Labs, and they really were just about all men, to use their open-ended license to be curious to shape so much of the way we live now. And Gertner is equally clear on what went wrong. AT&T lost its monopoly of the phone service and quite quickly found itself unable to support that kind of open-ended inquiry. The book's key moral, if we want to sustain the kind of research that answers questions we didn't even know we were asking, We're probably not going to get that out of current contemporary corporate research establishments. We're going to have to look for something different. As an aside, this is me talking, not Gertner's interpretation. It's not clear at all that asking research universities to run more like businesses will help the cause either. Gertner himself doesn't preach. He makes it clear that the circumstances that permitted Bell Labs to emerge were particular to a time and a very special technological moment. But as all good books do, and this is a very good one, the Idea Factory takes us beyond the facts it contains to force us to ask, what would it take now to get the same kinds of results that Bell Labs did then? It's a great read. I highly recommend it.
This is Amy Shira Title, blogger at Vintage Space and writer for Discovery News, Motherboard, and America Space, among others. I read a lot of books this year, but one that really stood out that I'd absolutely recommend is Mike Gray's Angle of Attack. Angle of Attack is what The Right Stuff would have been had it been about engineers and managers instead of hotshot test pilots turned astronauts. It's about North American aviation, and specifically one of the company's key engineers, Harrison Storms. North American did tons of awesome stuff in the early space age. In the 1950s, it built the X-15 rocket research aircraft, and in the 1960s, it built the second stage of the Saturn V, the rocket that took Apollo astronauts to the moon, and it built the Apollo Command and Service Modules. That's the part of the spacecraft that didn't actually go down to land on the moon's surface. Given the subject, Angle of Attack does tread some familiar ground, but it does so with a bit of a twist. It's a book about the space race that focuses on the unsung engineering heroes rather than the astronauts. Gray takes us inside meeting rooms where Storms and his colleagues develop the pitches that won them major Apollo contracts. He shows us the stress these men were under to keep their development schedules from slipping lest NASA miss its end-of-decade lunar landing goal. And he introduces us to a whole world of the space age that we don't really see in popular histories. And Gray does it all with a compelling narrative built on impressive research and original interviews. He even sneaks some really neat engineering knowledge in there, like his discussions of common bulkheads in the Saturn second stage, but he does it without alienating the non-engineering reader. Any lover of the space age and of Apollo would appreciate this book. If you've never heard of North American Aviation or Harrison Storms, you'll learn something about this different side of the space race. And if you are familiar with Stormy, you'll still probably learn something new. And if not, you'll at least enjoy the exciting story.
Hi there, I'm Bug Girl, and I have a serious problem with books. I read about 130 books a year, and that's actually, I'm kind of slowing down. So I read a lot of books, and there's actually two books that I want to tell you about. So the first one I would suggest is Spider Silk, and the author of this was actually interviewed on Skeptically Speaking. And it's just a really wonderful book about really evolution as much as it is about spiders. If you can tolerate having a few extra legs in your book, this is a great introduction to the history of spider evolution and also a great explanation of the mechanics of how evolution works. There's also even color pictures. You get an introduction to the chemistry of spider silk, but it's all very, very readable and a lot of fun. For the second book I'd like to give a mention to, that would be Incredible Arthropods. And this is actually a coloring book made by the Bug Chicks. And, I mean, it's essentially aimed at sort of the 5 to 10 crowd. Honestly, I spent way more time coloring this book than I kind of want to admit to. It was really a lot of fun. The illustrations are lovely, and most kids really do start out loving insects, and then for whatever reason, we manage to teach them that that's not cool. And so this is for the little kids who haven't learned yet that they should be afraid of insects, and you can maybe short-circuit that a little bit. And it's for big kids like me who are still in the rock-flipping stage and never really grew out of that. You can get it both as a paper version or you can get a digital version, load it up on your iPad, and color it over and over.
Bug Girl blogs at skeptchick.org and at membracid.wordpress.com. And that's it, folks. The best science books recommended by people who really know about these kinds of things. You'll find the links to all the books that they mentioned and more information on our guests in the show notes at skepticallyspeaking.com. While you're there, click the links to Twitter, Facebook, and Google+, where you can stay up to date on show news, and to iTunes, where you can subscribe to the podcast, listen to past episodes, or leave a review. From all of us here at Skeptically Speaking, have a safe and happy holiday. Thanks for listening.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. 'Cause we're skeptically speaking.